I have prepared a very short presentation that focuses on my recently published book, Beholding Beauty, about Sadi of Shiraz. I believe you can probably see my screen. The book has been published by Brill in December and was officially launched last week through the CNES Center at UCLA. It focused on Sadi's lyric poetry, and I'm very glad to share again parts of my aspects of my research that I already shared last year, exactly 1 year ago, through a marvelous panel organized, a wonderful workshop organized by Professor Marie Hubert at Stanford on Persian and Persian poetics. So I'm very glad to be back, albeit virtually. And I will share with you a few points that I think can help us discuss different aspects of Sadi's poetry in its historical and cultural context. If you're here, most of you already know who Sadi was. Here I have a brief sketch of his life and major works. We know very little about him. I've been relying on almost 30 old manuscripts that were copied between the end of the 13th century and the end of the 15th century in order to reframe the biography of this poet, about whom we know very little. And I've been trying also to rely on the same manuscripts to understand what kind of cultural, spiritual aspects can help us reconfigure and reassess the value and the meaning of his poetic production. As you can see here, this is one of the oldest manuscripts collecting the entirety of Sadi's works. It's a beautiful document copied probably toward the end of the 13th century. It's possible it was copied when Sadi was still alive or had died very recently, most likely toward in the 90s, late 90s of the 13th century, or maybe during the first decade of the 14th century. So it's an extremely interesting manuscript that is kept in the Academy of Science, the Library, the Academy of Science of the Republic of Tajikistan. As you can see, there is this mention here of the title, Sheikh al-Aref. We'll be talking about what Sheikh means and what Aref can refer to. And here you have these beautiful sort of discs that are listing the different titles of Sadi's works. What we know almost for sure that Sadi studied at the renowned Nizamiya school in Baghdad, probably in the 1230s. And he was probably at least initially loosely attached to the Suravardiya Sufi order. And we also know that he did seek political and literary patronage throughout his entire life. The major works that made Sadi renowned throughout the entirety of the Middle Ages and the modern period, both in the Persian world, both in the Persian speaking world and in the West, are the so-called Sadiname or Bustan, probably composed in the 1250s and finally completed in 1257, and the Golestan or Rose Garden, also composed during the same decade. The focus of my book, as I mentioned, are Sadi's lyric poems or ghazals, which surprisingly have been celebrated for centuries by almost all major scholars in the Persian-speaking world. And until the 19th century, Sadi was a major figure in the Western understanding of the literary heritage of Iran. But his ghazals have never really reached the level of conversations that one would expect from such a major poet. So while today most learned Western readers have surely heard about Rumi or Hafez or of course Ferdowsi, Sadi's poetry is still something that escapes the attention of scholarly conversations. And that's why I decided to write a book about this. I I've been reading multiple times the roughly 700 ghazals that are found in his 3+1, we can talk about this, collections of poems, the divans by Sa'di. They were composed, I also tried to date the different collections and when they were likely put together, even though this is still a debatable topic. So we know for sure that there was this first corpus collected around the 1250s called the Taghibat or the Delights, then the Marvels or Badayeh in the 60s of the same century, and finally the final seals of the Khawatim in the 1270s. What I've tried to also to study is the relationship between the serious love amatory poetry that is found in terms of topics, in terms of themes that is found in Sa'di's ghazals, and the obscene works, as well as the praise poem. So I've tried to also to contextualize the lyric production that was produced by this poet within the broader, larger framework of his other works in different kinds of registers and different styles and different genres. So to see how his lyric voice could interact at multiple levels with a plurality of overarching themes and ideals. It's important to keep track of the patrons who for whom Sa'di would write, whose courts he would flourish. He flourished mainly the Salhuri dynasty, the so-called Atabegan Efars, and after 1260, the Juvani family, who were the most important Mongol, Persian-speaking Mongol notables of the time. We can also include the several Shirazi religious scholars and a network of intellectuals and poets such as Majdi Hamgar, Fakhreddin Isfahani, other Ilkhanid Sufi poets, Seyfi Farghani and Humame Tabrizi. We'll be also talking briefly about the influence of Sa'di in this sort of later Ilkhanid poets. As you can see, I'm showing some of the highlights in terms of manuscript tradition, on which I've been relying to focus on specific details that can be interesting for our conversation. One of which is this extremely important manuscript that's never been really studied, has never been used for any scholarly work on Sa'di, and it has never been used for any of the extant editions, critical editions of Sa'di's works. The problem, we do have a plethora of manuscripts containing the majority of Sa'di's works, but the problem is that we still need to look even more carefully about this manuscript tradition, because the critical editions that are found in today's market need to be reconsidered. And I've tried in my book to reread the ghazals in light of the evidence that emerges from these manuscripts. And this extremely important manuscript that I'm referring to here is, it comes from the private collection of King Muhammad Zahir Shah. So from his personal library collection, it was copied in, the previous king of Afghanistan. So the national, today is kept in the National Archives of Afghanistan. It was copied in 1325 CE. So extremely important, because it's one of the oldest documents. You can see here how in the cartouche in the top of this folio, Sa'di is referred to as Malek al-Shu'ara, the king of the poets or poet laureate. This title appears in another important manuscript, even earlier than this, copied in 1306 CE by a certain Banakati, who was a historian and also a poet. And he was active at the court of the Ilkhanid ruler Ghazan. So you can see here, Malek al-Shu'ara is also used as a title. We can have a conversation about why Malek al-Shu'ara was used this and what this title, what this epithet tells us about the connection between Sa'di and the courtly circles of his time, especially from the political point of view of his poetic endeavors. In this book, I've tried to address some of the main prejudices and biases that surround our modern reception of Sadiq's poetry. Usually Sadiq, and I'm glad that I attended Dr. Milani's talk yesterday at Chicago, and Dr. Milani addressed the fact that Sadiq is usually perceived as a poet who focuses exclusively on ethical and didactic dimensions. It is true, the ethical discourse is one among many other dimensions, but this is part of a general project in which the poet endeavored to look to quest for a golden mean as a nuanced balance between mundanity and spirituality, also as tools that were put at the service of good government. The distance from political power, this is something that has also occupied and preoccupied generations of scholars and readers. Sadiq did offer and sought actively, actually, the favor of rulers and patrons throughout his entire life, especially when courting the favors of younger princes. And I will elaborate on this because I read this with it from the perspective of some kind of ritualized erotic kingship. The heteronormative biases are also very important, very common. Sadiq's usually, the homoerotic dimensions of Sadiq is usually repressed or is usually hidden, is not discussed as much as should be. And it's important also to specify that Sadiq should not be seen, should not be read through the lens of contemporary polarity between homoronormative and heteronormative standards. Sadiq's homoeroticism is a kind of a functional homoeroticism that relates to ritualized ideals of kingship and sacred forms of eroticism. So we are completely far from the idea of homosexuality in the modern Western terms. Sadiq is often portrayed as a primarily mystical poet or as an exclusively erotic poet. I try to bridge the gap between these two tendencies. And I also try to show how important philosophical thought filtered through Sufi thought was in the development of Sadiq's lyric voice. This is something that is usually dismissed, mainly because Sadiq wrote only one specific technical treatise on Sufism with very strong philosophical influences. But at the same time, his style is so plain, so smooth. He's famous for the so-called Sahd Montané, or inimitable smoothness, that when reading his poetry, is the temptation is to think that there is absolutely no thought, there is no philosophical thought behind the lyric production of this poet. So I will, I have the book, which is here, can be divided into three different parts, and each part can be read as a semi-independent study. So it's divided according to and sort of a medieval anthropological approach. So the first part focuses on the body, the second part focuses on the soul, and the third part focuses on the enactment of the relationship between the body and the soul. So the first part, which is titled Uncovering the Skin of the Ghazal, deals with the more secular, mundane, physical aspects of Sadiq's poetry. So the historiographical understanding we can have of this, of his works, his connection with his patrons. I try to rewrite completely the facts of his life, you know, as much as I could, and I've been focusing also on his non-spiritual aspect of his lyricism, and I'm showing here another manuscript, extremely beautiful, kept in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, BNF. It was copied in 1461, so it was a late Timurid manuscript by Abdallah Heravi, also known as Tabakh. This is a beauty. You can see that this is Nasr calligraphy at its finest, example. And this is a specific poem of praise dedicated to a young minister of the Ilkhani finances, His name was Shams ad-Din Jowaini. You can see here on the top right of the folio, Mahdi Khwaja Shams ad-Din Sahib Divan. Sahib Divan was his title. And you can see the kind of discourse that he enacts when praising such political figures. May God be exalted for converting vulgar liquids into a marvelous painting. Your splendid countenance, your eyes, your hair, your forehead. No description can honor what the gaze sees in you. To what end should I describe you? Look at yourself in the mirror. Since God molded Adam's clay and painted humankind, he has from mud extracted no semen as splendid as your origin. You do not belong to Adam's progeny, as in God's paradise, the beauty of the Huris does not reach your perfection. So much do the eyes desire you that bewilderment reigns, as if watching Yusuf, the knife cuts through the hands and the citrons. The lords of gazes, Ahl-e Nazar, cannot but marvel in silence, as praise cannot embrace your limitless beauty. No room in my mouth for the lord of your lips, as no mouth, no lips can pronounce the precious treasuries of pearls. And if Ibn Muqla, the calligrapher, should come back to the world, in spite of him claiming as miraculous the manifest magic of his pen, he would not be able to paint in gold an alif similar to your stature, nor would he with molten silver lend the sin of your smile. Especially to see how the relationship between the beauty of a human figure and calligraphy is something that is found throughout Sa'di's works. And I had a very interesting conversation a few months ago with a dear colleague of mine, Lamia Balafrej, Professor Balafrej, who teaches art history at UCLA. And we did reflect on the possibility of the role of Sa'di in the development of the aesthetics of calligraphy and manuscript production throughout the 14th and 15th centuries. Especially considering that, as the title of my book suggests, beauty and the observation, the contemplation of beauty, can be considered as the main pole, the main focus of the entirety of Sa'di's production. So this is why I try to show to colleagues and readers that it is necessary now to transition from a perspective that is predominantly ethical on Sa'di to a perspective that takes into account the relevance of his aesthetic discourse, his celebration of beauty. The second chapter is Movements and Gaze in the Rose Garden. I try to reframe the importance of this poetry within the context of his major prose and verse work, The Golestan or The Rose Garden. I try to see how biographical experiences, political engagement, and some sort of fictive sensuality, what role they play into the emergence of Sa'di's own lyric voice. This is also another folio from the manuscript that is kept in Tashkent. Here you can see how in the introduction, I focused a lot on the introduction of the Golestan. Introductions, unfortunately, are the parts of the book, this is what I tell my students all the time, that we usually dismiss and we don't really take into account very seriously. And I try to analyze quite finally every single passage that could open new windows in our understanding of Sa'di's poetry. In this case, I was interested in seeing the connection between Sa'di and the young prince, Sa'd, son of Abu Bakr. So you can see that Mahdi Atabege, Sa'd bin Abi Bakr, ben Sa'd. So we have Sa'd the first, who was the very first, one of the most important rulers in the very first decades of the 13th century in Shiraz. He was succeeded by Abu Bakr, and then his prince ruled only for a few days, Sa'd the second. And I think that this specific Sa'd here, who was a teenager when Sa'di returned to Shiraz sometime in the 40s, early 40s, is the person who bestowed upon Sa'di his takhallus or pen name. So Sa'di derives most likely from Sa'd the second, this young prince. And it's interesting how in the scholarship, this is not really emphasized. And when this specific passage is found and is read, is commented upon in the critical editions that are found in the market, this Sa'd is not really read as the main recipient. as the main interlocutor of Sadis, of the Golestan. And it's interesting that here we can see he's describing how the book was composed. And Sadis says, Vataman, Vataman Angah Shavad, Beharigat, Ke Pasandide, Pasandide Oyad, Barbargohe, Shahe, Johan Penah, Vasayege, Parvardegaro, Partobe, Lotfe, Kerdegar. It is interesting that toward the end of the series of titles that appear here after the mention of the name of Sad, Prince Sad, Sadis says, the book will be completed vartiket motole e farmayad. So the act of reading, the prince reading the book, partakes in the action of composing the book itself. So I'm trying to see how this special formulaic, homoerotic, almost social connection between Sadi and Prince Saad animates some of the aesthetic components of the Golestan. And then the third chapter, this part is something that has been suppressed, has not been really studied with the kind of scholarly dedication that it requires, is the obscene aspect. I've tried to see how the obscene in Sadi's poetry can his Hadisat or Hasl can be read as a countertext of his more serious production, and to see how Sadi is not subversive through this kind of obscene lines because of their content, because of the excesses that sometimes they represent and they portray, but because he does reflect a tradition, a Persian tradition of literary pornography, but he adds an element of literary elegance to it, which can be witnessed in this. You have the Persian original text from the Kabul manuscript. And he says, how beautiful it is to offer one's heart to a beloved, a moon-faced beauty so graciously noble and elegant, his delicate feet wearing many sandals, manly sandals, on his head a coarse hat in the fashion of muleteers, a beardless boy whose chest is wrapped in a woolen cloth, is much more handsome than a girl covered by the veil. Girls need gold, fine garments, and ornaments to entice the passion of their husbands. Many ornaments are needed to beautify their bodies. A musky mole, a fine and dark downy beard won't suffice. The brides of paradise cover their head with veils. I love hemp garments on a beauty's chest. Better than me, no one can describe how the tunic closes and opens from behind the neck. When a boy lays his silver chin on the ground, the bed is an ornament in full display. Commonly, young men, shohed, are all that a city needs, no more than one sun out to shine upon a country. The kings sleep on verandas, manzar, that overlook beautiful vistas. The veranda of the mystics, arifan, is the back of a beautiful boy. I'm interested in the way that Sadi brings in a discourse on spirituality. And he makes use of technical words like shahed and aref in this kind of pornographic output to offer us a different point of view on the connection between the soul and the body, between the idealized celebration of beauty and the more naturalistic, almost rougher, more mundane ways of talking about the body from a different point of view. And this is why I endeavor to show the entanglements between eroticism, politics, and mysticism or spirituality or Sufism. And this is an interesting manuscript from the early 14th century. It collects the works of a famous poet, Homame Tabrizi, who was also active at the court of the Jouveni family. And here in this very specific manuscript, we can see how Sadi influenced the connection between eroticism and power and mysticism in the relationship between Homame Tabrizi and Ilkhanid ruler. So there is this beautiful lines that open a long qasida that Sadi wrote sometime in the 1260s to celebrate the beauty of the army, the beauty of the Mongol army in Shiraz when he was paying homage to the Ilkhanid dynasty ruling over Fars at this point. And it's interesting to see how Razan, late Ilkhanid ruler, one of the first rulers also who converted to Islam with the name of Mahmud, asked, he heard Sadi's poem and asked Muhammad Tabrizi to craft a response that blends here visions of paradise with the with mundane power. So you can see here that Hammam imagines the beauties, beauties that make up the Ilkhanid army as beautiful boys from paradise who are descending upon earth to kiss the threshold of the Ilkhan of our time, Ghazan, the king of the world. And this opens a whole debate on the controversy on the mystical or mundane nature of Sadi's lyric poems. We heard this all the time. Is Sadi's poetry mystical? Is it purely mundane and exclusively erotic? It is important to remember that the oldest manuscripts that collect Sadi's works attest to the circulation of Sadi's poetry among communities of readers that belong to both Sufi and courtly cultural networks. Sufism and courtly mundanity are extremely important. They're part of the same framework in this context. And it's also, but this, I discovered that this manuscript that has been studied in the past, but for some reason, this specific folio was never really analyzed by anyone else. And there is this specific description of how and when Sadi's Sufi Lodge was built, probably in 1281 or 1282, through Shamsuddin Jouveni again, and for how much money, also how much was invested, and where, in the outskirts of Shiraz, in an area known as Fahandar or Fahandez. The manuscript here says Fahandar, like coming from Pahandar. It's possible that he is a mistake in the transcription in the copy of the copies. It could be Fahan or Pahandej or Kohan Pahandej. So this is an important document to understand better that Sadi was actually active and did have a Sufi lodge that he was, where his own poetry was performed during the so-called mystical concerts or Sama rituals. And here we get to the part two, which is the central part of the book. I'll try to be as brief and concise as possible. Through the mirror or your glances. Here, after having explored the mundane, material, physical aspect of Sadi's poetry, I try to show the complexity of his of the sacred aesthetics that determine the development of his lyric, the development of his lyric subject. It's divided into two sub parts. So the first two chapters separated by an interlude, and then two other chapters. I can show you why I did this. And the second part, which is chapter 4 and 5, the body is a divine sign, the hermeneutic of spiritual desire, and chapter 5, the RF as a beholder, the divine pen depicting the chat of the beloved. Through these chapters, I try to frame the spiritual aspect of Sadi's act of contemplating human beauty through two different modalities. There is one rational inferential modality. Keywords such as Ibrat, Tafakkur, Ta'amul belong to this modality. And there is a second modality that I call imaginal cosmological that has to do with Alam-e Ghaib, Lo-e Mahfuz, and so on. So the first two chapters deal with this first modality. There is one chapter, chapter number 6, on medieval Avicennian cognition and psychology. And the second part, chapter 7 and 8 focus on this imaginal cosmological modality. The rational inferential modality relates to the question of how does the human beloved, the mashu' in Sadi's poetry, reflect divine beauty? Is the beloved an incarnation of God? Does he iconically signal God's ineffable presence? How can we reassess the problem of the vision of God in the context of Sadi's poetry? Because it's clear that the beloved is not God. This is a mistake that many commentators make still today. There's this strange confusion, that which is theologically problematic even, of seeing the Mashuk as God. The Mashuk is never actually God, but can be represented as a reflection, as a physical reflection of divine beauty. And Sadi meditates on this problem. He says, you appear in the morning and no one bows down to worship your face. Why? People fear God, whereas I am too bewildered to prostrate. مردم از ترس خدا سجده رویت نکنند. بامدادت که ببینند و من از حیرانی. On the page, like cheek of the beautiful ones, they see the downy beard, the hat, the beard of the beloved. Short is their sight, but the beholder, the Aref, contemplates the pen of God's creation. چشم کوته نظران بر ورق صورت خوبان خط همی بیند و عارف قلم سن خدا را. I call it rational inferential because the beloved, the human beloved, is an inference, it's a sign, it's a semiotic system that points to the beauty of God, but it's not actually God. So there is, I try through chapters 4 and 5 to make sense of the rational aspect of this spiritual semiotic system and how Sadi deals with that. The second modality has to do with the problem of the unseen. Sadi does talk about the ghaib, olam ghaib, on many occasions. And I remember when I was a student also, I often asked myself, what is this ghaib? What is the ghaib? What is the world of the unseen? What is this invisible world? Look, for instance, about this ghazal, the very short ghazal. Behold, someone is coming from the garden of paradise. A star is crossing the sky, or maybe an angel is coming. A sweet beauties appear from the world of the unseen. The salt of passion opens wounds in the hearts of the dear companions. One breath abandons my life, and one more breath comes back, so that for one breath, the intimacy with the beloved is bestowed upon me. O Sadi, the sorrow of loving him is a sultan, and his army shall seize the kingdom. Your life, his night watch is coming. Amkaz jannat firdos yaki miyad, farmi gzarad ya malaki miyad. Har shikar parike dar mirsad az alam ghayb, bar dil rish azizan namaki miyad. Tamagar yafte gardad nafasi sohbat dost, nafasi mirabad az omro yaki miyad. The problem of the contemplation of the invisible world relates to the question of the preserved tablet, which is a Quranic term, Lauh Mahfuz, modern Persian, the magics of the book, or as I try to demonstrate in Avicennian cosmological terms, according to the cosmological system of Ibn Sina, which influenced deeply the entirety of the cultural circles in which Sadi was flourishing between Baghdad and Shiraz, during the second half of the 13th century, called the soul of the fixed stars of the active intellect. The body, along with its carnal passions and external perceptions, veils the heart and prevents it from visualizing the supernal realm of the unseen. So we're still talking about the act of beholding beauty, but this is a kind of contemplation that is metaphysical and involves the body of the beholder. And it's interesting how I've been comparing also different Sufi treatises and philosophical works to show how material this experience is and how important it is for us to focus on the physiological aspects of the techniques that are involved in the practice of the Sufis to visualize the alam-e ghaib. Dreams, for instance, are something that is usually described, and I've been working mainly on a treatise in Persian called Kimya-i Saadat, The Alchemy of Bliss by Imam al-Ghazali, who died in 1111 and was also heavily influenced by Avicennian philosophy. Spiritual training, Yazat, observation of the sacred law, repetition of formula leading to the obfuscations of external perceptions, sensory deprivation, renunciation. Sama, which is a ritualized exposure to music and lyric poetry leading to ecstatic states. The teleological contemplation, the world, looking at the beauty of the girl, contemplating beauty, contemplating erotically also the beauty of the human forms to obtain a taste, the velt or zok of the invisible. So I tried with this two final chapters of the second part of my book to make sense of this. And the bridge between these two modalities is held together by the sixth chapter, in which I explore the role of the internal sense in the rational soul of Avicennian origin to trace the psychology of the lyric savage. Of course, when I say psychology, I refer to medieval psychology, which is the study of the soul and study of cognition and perception, the connection with the cosmological realm in which cognition takes place. See, look at these lines. So pervasive is the depiction of the beloved in my imagination that no intelligibles are any longer depicted in my mind. چنان تصور معشوق در خیال من است که دیگرم متصور نمی شود معقول. Everyone's mind imagines someone's beautiful face, but the one I imagine is beyond imagination. And then from the aperture of my thinking, فکرت, my heart showed to the rational soul, نفس ناطقه, the signs of my desperation. And I've been relying heavily on this system, right? The way that in the Abyssinian tradition, models of cognition rotate around the complexity of the imagination, how five different internal senses interact with external senses, and for spiritual purposes, they can interact with the world of the invisible world, which is the matrix of creation. And this is what the Sufi on the path strives to acquire as an ecstatic and ecstatic experience. So I try to shift. The question for me is not what is the nature of the beloved. The problem is not to determine whether the beloved is real, whether the beloved corresponds to God, whether the beloved is God or not. The problem for me is how does the lyric subject think? How does the lyric subject, the oshe in Sadi's poetry, perceive and cognize the world and the visual imagined presence of the beloved in the context of a mental contact with the unseen? So we shift from spiritual hermeneutics to a psychophysiological model of cognition. Overall, how can we account for the relationship between the descriptions of visual experiences, tangible visual encounters, dreams, and imagined ideals of beauty, which are all found in the entirety of Sa'di's corpus? And his ghazals somehow are the most perfect, the most clear example of the complexity of these entanglements between the experience, the physical experience of the world, the imagination, dreams, and the quest for a supernal ideal of beauty. And I will close with these lines. So this says, everyone seeks something and desires someone, whereas we covet no other desires but you. Through the mirror of my imaginings, no other forms and limbs would be ever be depicted as beautiful as you are. And this is the actual final, the final ghazal. You left, but you still linger in my imagination. It seems that you are being depicted before my eyes. Okay, I show in this ghazal how the technical terms of Avicennian theory of cognition is at work in a very specific way in Sa'di's poetry. My cogitations cannot reach the apogee of your beauty, as you are more beautiful than anything my imagination ever conjured. Fekram be montahai jamalat nemi rasad, kas harche dar khiyal man amad nekutari. The moon never walked on earth, no eyes ever apprehended a fairy. How can I think of you as a fairy, of your face as a moon? You're an angel indeed, for you were not conceived from this clay. Humans are made of water and earth, you from pure musk and ambergris. Too much weeping for you may ruin my eyes, but who cares? You are more precious than the eyes that are lodged in my sockets. Sa'di, as your hands cannot reach the encounter with the beloved, for once you shall dedicate your time to remembering him. And I conclude this presentation with just a mention of part three of the book. We don't have time to go through this, in which I focus on the lyrical ritual somehow and the performance and performative space of sacred eroticism. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Professor, for a wonderful talk. We have lots of questions and comments, so I'm gonna try to get to a few of them quickly. To start with, just a few quick questions about the book itself. A viewer is asking if the book contains the original Persian poems and if the pages of the manuscript you showed in your presentation are also in the book.
Yes, thank you for this question. Yes, I have a large appendix with all where all the original texts are presented, and it's easy to flip back and forth between the English translations and the original text. I attempted to also to reconstruct them by taking a look at the manuscripts. So it is my own critical edition of these specific poems that I analyze. And what was it? Yes, and the manuscripts are all described. They're all listed and described one by one. And I do refer to the actual folio. So some of these manuscripts are available online. So it's also an invitation for other scholars to collaborate and contribute to this field.
Great, thank you. Viewer asks, could you shed some light on why Saadi has been known as a Sufi or Arif in the subcontinent, his name showing up in many Chisti hagiographies as one of the sheikhs, while in Iran he had been known only as a poet and ethicist?
He was known for both, and depends on it depends on the circles of transmissions. So it is clear that in 14th century Iran, Saadi was known as a Shaire Aref, not as Aref Shaire, which is an important distinction. A poet who had spiritual endeavors, not a mystic who would also compose poetry. This is a very important distinction. And in my book, I also try to show how important was the circulation of his poetry during the second half of the 13th century in the Delhi Sultanate through the Sohrawardia order. So that's why that I talk about a loose connection with the Sohrawardia order and how in the subcontinent, Saadi very early on, he was even invited to Delhi to join the court and the connection between order between the sultans and in that city and the poetic and spiritual activities that were taking place. And that's why that his renown crystallized in that way. Whereas in Iran, he became a monument soon after the 14th and 15th centuries. And so it is clear that in the way that it was approached and reread, Jami, for instance, called Saadi the very first lyric poet, the very poet who formalizes the Ghazal, and subsequent tradition lost track of the importance of the spiritual aspect. And works such as the Golestan became much more important and commented upon, especially during the Ottoman Safavid periods, and rather than his actual lyric poetry.
Thank you. There are many comments from viewers thanking you for your work and your presentation and looking forward to reading the book. One viewer writes, thank you for an excellent presentation. I am in awe of the depth of your research. As a Persian, I would like to express my gratitude to you for offering this cultural gift to our community. I am interested to know about the first impulse that took you on this path. And another viewer also asks, what attracted you to Saadi Shirazi?
The beauty of the poetry. I mean, I remember I was my teachers in Naples in the Oriental Institute in Naples taught me that Saadi is a wonderful tool to learn Persian as a language, but he's a moralist and there's nothing really interesting about him, and his ghazals were never even mentioned when I was studying Hafez, Rumi, and Ferdowsi, and I wrote my dissertation on the Obeidi Zakani on his serious poetry, but I never really was interested in Saadi's ghazals. And then by chance, when I was living in Tehran, I started reading his ghazals, and I was fascinated by the complexity and the beauty and this actual inimitable style. And inimitable smoothness means that even when we try to translate Saadi's poetry, and I apologize for the unpolished nature of my translations, which I consider as a constant work in progress, and I do believe that Saadi is by far the most untranslatable of all poets, more than Hafez, because of the crystal clear transparency of his style. So this was the main factor that attracted me initially. So to crack the secret of this beauty.
Thank you. Another viewer, thanks you for your presentation, and writes, the good governance dimension of Saadi poetry that you mentioned at the start of the talk was very interesting. Do the Mongol conquests figure into Saadi's poetry in the context of that dimension?
It is, and I do analyze the role that the Atabekane Fars played in conquering Baghdad and helping the Mongols invade that city and establishing their power in Iran. And I also analyzed Saadi's attempt to offer guidance to this princess. And so he knew what kind of major disaster could have fallen upon Shiraz. And that's why Shiraz was never really fully conquered. It was never really destroyed. So the destiny of Shiraz, I think that Saadi's presence, to some extent, saved the city of Shiraz and Fars from the Mongol threat. I go this far in my book and I try to demonstrate in what specific key historical moments Saadi's presence was relevant for this historiographical approach.
Thank you. Another viewer writes, could you maybe expand a bit on the reasons why reading the beloved as an image of God is actually theologically problematic?
It's problematic because there is a term that is hulul or incarnationism that is something that cannot ever be considered as acceptable from a theological point of view. Two souls, two spirits cannot inhabit one single body. And God is by definition one, and the oneness of God cannot be diffracted or deconstructed through imagining his presence in one body. So the metaphor that is usually explored in this kind of poetry is the metaphor of the mirror. So if we look at the mirror, we see an image, but it does not mean that the mirror possesses that image. It's just something that shines upon briefly on the surface. And is not even identical. Does not coincide with the origin of that beauty. This is why. And it's interesting that still in sort of pseudo mystical readings of many of 14th century and 15th century Persian poems, we still read this idea that the beloved is God. But this is absolutely an absurd from a theological point of view, mainly.
Thank you. Just a clarification question. One viewer asks, what is the actual name of Sa'di versus his title? And another viewer asks, is there any evidence that Sa'di and Rumi knew each other?
Evidence of Sa'di and Rumi meeting each other, there is no real evidence of this. There are veiled references to each other that need to be explored. And I read Sa'di and Rumi as two completely different poets who probably knew about each other and embraced the discourse, the metaphysical discourse, in different ways. And it's possible that the references to their connection still lack real investigation. So it's something we need to, one of the most interesting approaches to this would be to analyze the so-called response poems and to see how Sa'di might have responded to Rumi and vice versa. And I do this in parts of my book in which I try to show the difference between these two poets through these comparisons, where the form is the same, the rhyme is the same, the meter is also the same, but there are completely different ways of approaching the act of contemplating beauty for spiritual ends. As far as the name, it's still debatable. It's still the problem of the name of Sa'di. What I try to establish on the basis of the sources is explained page 10 of my book, and Musharraf ad-Din Musleh. This is what I adopt, but I, in the footnotes, I try to point at the whole problematic of stemming from this definition, and it's something that probably we will never know about, but Musharraf ad-Din Musleh seems to be what most of the oldest sources agree upon.
Thank you. A couple similar questions. Is the homosexuality in Sa'di's writings comparable to ancient Greek eroticism? And in which epoch in Middle Ages or modernity of Muslim power and Persian literature did erotic poetry begin to see itself as immoral and as an unforgiven sin?
This is an interesting issue. I addressed this in the first two chapters of my book. I would not call this homosexuality, because homosexuality is a concept that the way we frame it is related mostly to identity in the Western world, in the Western sort of the discourse on same-sex desires and relationships. I would refer to this as homosociality, same-sex eroticism, or homoeroticism in general. And it's usually intergenerational. And Sa'di has different opinions about this. And it's interesting to see how he frames different ethical stands according to the framework and the genres in which he's writing. And then I prefer not to respond to the second part of this question, because it deserves a whole lecture. But it is a topic that has been discussed, and Professor Catherine Babayan from the University of Michigan, for instance, has been approaching this problem from the point of view of the Safavid Iran, And Professor Afsaneh Najmabadi has written about this as far as Qajar, Iran is concerned. So I've referred to these publications, to these scholars, to explore this point of view in the modern world.
Thank you. How was Saadi received in the Western part of the Islamic world?
He was read throughout the Ottoman lands. Saadi was extensively studied and read, and he was also one of the main sources of inspirations for generations of scholars and poets. He was constantly imitated and reread. So Saadi, of course, these kind of trends happen within the framework of the Persianate world. So any cultural regions that were deeply influenced by the Persian language and culture, between the, even as far as the Balkans, you know, if you go westward, as far as the Indian Ocean and even Southeast Asia, Saadi was circulated. So as long as Persian was a cultural presence, Saadi was there, absolutely.
Thank you. On that note of his reach, we actually have a comment from a viewer who says, I'm from Tanzania and we have African Shiraz communities. Do you know any stories of how Shirazis carried Saadi's poetry to Africa and of Saadi's poetry in Swahili? And also a comment from another viewer who says, many thanks for your informative presentation. I'm from India. Was Saadi Shirazi also represented in Indian traditions of Persia?
With these questions, we're pushing the boundaries of my comfort zone, and they're brilliant questions. I wish I could respond, but this is an open field, and I'm particularly interested in the influence of Persian culture in African studies and the African manuscript tradition. And it's clear that, especially in the island of Zanzibar, which has most likely a Persian origin, the name itself was heavily influenced by the presence of Shirazi traders. I'm interested in the introduction. I try to show also how important the Salghurid presence in the Indian Ocean and in Persian Gulf was for the dissemination of Saadi's poetry. So for a couple of decades, the Salghurids were ruling Fars and Shiraz, but also almost the entirety of the Persian Gulf and parts of the western part of the Indian Ocean, up to Gujarat in some ports, and in some cases the Friday mosques in these coastal communities would read the khutbah in the name of Abu Bakr, who was Saadi's first patron. And I'm absolutely sure that this contributed to the circulation of Saadi's poetry in this broader coastal areas.
Thank you. One viewer writes, you made a point that Saadi was more of a poet who had musical leanings and not as a mystic who wrote poetry. Could you expand on this more?
Because Saadi never embraces one system of Sufi values as a scholastic framework. He never specifies what kind of Sufi order he belonged to. I did recognize connections with the Sohrawardiyya and the power that the Sohrawardiyya, especially as far as the Futuwa was on the Javanmardi in Persian, was influential in Baghdad and Shiraz during those decades. But he cannot, and in this I agree partially with what Professor Milani says when he says that Saadi has nothing to do with Sufism. It has nothing to do with the more scholastic aspects of Sufism. He embraces Sufi aesthetics and Sufi ideals in ways that were functional for his ethical and aesthetic endeavors throughout his poetry, throughout the composition of his poetry.
Thank you. In your opinion, what is the most unique or most outstanding aspect of Saadi?
The transparent perfection of his style in poetry. I think so. I think this is something that it's bewildering. It's bewildering because for instance, there is one specific rhetorical device called Genasetam, which we can translate almost in English as paronomasia, which is the repetition of a word in the same line with a slight shift in meaning. So like I say the same words twice and the second instance means something different within the same line. And it generates a very smooth, almost invisible progression of meaning. And we don't really see the repetition. We don't see, so he's a master of this kind of minimalism. So that's what really inspires me the most.
Thank you so much, Professor. We're just at time. There were many more questions and comments, many thanking you for your presentation and your work. Just a reminder that in the chat, there is a link to the book with a generous discount from the publisher if you're looking to purchase the book. We hope the next time we see you, it will be at Stanford. Congratulations on the book. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Roma. Thank you very much, Frank, also for taking care of the logistics of this encounter. Thank you, Professor Ostad Abbasi Milani. And thank you to the Center for Iranian Studies at Stanford. It was an absolute pleasure.